you've been a talk show host, you've been a stand-up comedian. What brought you to writing a play about growing up in San Leandro, California?
Well, it's actually kind of a long story. At the end of the day, I'm a stand-up and a writer. I've been a stand-up since I was 18. I started performing in comedy clubs the week after I graduated high school. So I had about 20 years of that in, you know, working in clubs and concert halls across the country and touring with folks like Smokey Robinson and Aretha Franklin and Natalie Cole and Dionne Warwick. And I came to a place in 2001 where I had gone through a divorce. I had custody of my three kids, who were at the time first grade, fifth grade, seventh grade. And I was just kind of going crazy, spinning my wheels, because I couldn't tour, and I was just kind of fed up what I was doing. So 9/11 hit, and I will never forget watching CNN, and they did an interview with the president of Cantor Fitzgerald. I can't remember which tower they were that broker's firm was in. But the deal was that this gentleman was the first at his office every single day. This particular day, 9/11, he was his kid's first day of school, so he went to school with him instead. And he was not there when the plane hit, but everybody else was, and he lost something like 99% of his employees. So I'm watching this story, and they went to a break, and they had this montage. They were showing pictures of his employees. They were all different ages, shapes, sizes, colors. And I'm looking at these people thinking, wow, they got up this morning and they kissed their husbands and wives and kids and said, hey, we'll see you tonight. You know, and, you know, someday we're going to go to Europe, and someday I'm going to teach you how to ski, and someday. Then they sat down at their desks and they were dead. And I started to cry, and I'm thinking, God, you never know when your plane is going to hit your tower. So I decided then I'm going to do everything I always said I was going to do someday. And I took out a yellow legal pad, and I made a list. I called it my someday list. Today you'd call it a bucket list.
And you were in that movie.
And I'm in that movie, which is funny how that worked out, because, you know, that was not in the vernacular then. That right. that film is what made that list. So the top of the list was to do a one-man show. I'd wanted to do that for years, you know, where you take stand-up. However, you don't have to be so focused on the laughs. You can have a story, and you can, you know, talk about some serious issues. But I didn't know what to write about. So a couple weeks later, I have Carl Reiner, who's one of my comedy idols, on my KGO program. And during a break, I tell Carl, you know, I'm at this place. I want to write this play. I have no idea what to write about. And Carl said to me, every writer-performer comes to this crossroads. He says, for me, it was 1959. Sid Caesar's show just ended. I'd been with Caesar for 9 years, and I'm thinking, I want to do something. Well, what do I do? And he said, somebody gave him a copy of Fred Allen, the great radio comics book, Treadmill to Oblivion. And in the intro, he talks about how you have to find the piece of ground that you alone stand on and that nobody else does, and write from there. And Fred Allen's piece of ground was he'd spent 18 years at NBC network radio dealing with knuckleheads who just didn't get his comedy. So that's what he wrote about. So Carl thought, what's my piece of ground? I'm a married comedy writer. I live in New Rochelle with my wife and kids, and I write for a variety show in New York. And you're nodding. So that became
The Dick Van Dyke Show.
So he said to me, you've got to find your own piece of ground. And I go, I have no idea what that is. He goes, that's what you got to figure out. So I took off a couple of weeks, and I came back on the station, and there was all this mail piled up from when I was gone, and I'm going through it, and it was one particular letter that stuck out because it was typewritten with a typewriter. If it hadn't been, I might not have even opened it. And I opened it up, it's unsigned, and it says, as an African American, I'm disgusted every time I hear your voice because you are not a genuine black man. And I said, bingo, no more calls, we have a winner. That's it. That's my piece of ground, because I've heard this nonsense for a good deal of my life from white people. Oh, you're not really black. You're black, but you're not really black. And African Americans will say nonsense like that. So I went through this whole litany, you know, okay, why did they say that? How I dress, how I talk, you know, because I like watching Frasier. You know, why is it they say that? And I realized that because I grew up from the age of 8 in San Leandro, California, which was then 99% white, and I grew up as the only black face in the room. And you, especially in your formative years, you assimilate. You don't want to be the one who's different. They said, that's it. I'm going to write a play about what it was like to be the only one. Because at some point in your life, you're going to be the only one. The only man, only woman, only Jew, only Christian, only black, only white. And how do you navigate those waters when you're the one who's different? So I would walk my kids to school in the morning, and I sat at this little cafe by my house called Sabino's with number 2 natural wood pencils and marble composition notebooks, and I wrote every story I could think of about what it was like to be the only one. Some were funny, some were heavy. I realized there were a lot of things I had forgotten on purpose because there was so much pain involved. So I wrote it like I was writing a diary, with the mindset nobody's ever going to see this, so that way I wouldn't censor myself. So after I had about a dozen of these notebooks or so filled front and back pages, I thought, well, let me go to the San Leandro Library and look through microfilms of old newspapers to see what was going on in town in order to have some context for this. So I go in and I see the head librarian, Cindy Simmons, who's since written a book about San Leandro herself, and I told her I'm writing a play about what it was like to grow up when there weren't that many black people there, and she said, I got something you need to see. And she takes me in the back, opens up a file cabinet, and gives me this yellowing stack of typewritten papers. And the title was, How San Leandro's 10 Homeowners Associations Keep the City an All-White Ghetto. It was a sociology paper from a 1969 term paper at Cal State, Hayward at the time, now Cal State East Bay. So in this, written by a gentleman named Don Magnifico, was the gentleman's name who wrote it. And in this, he'd interviewed contemporary residents. I found out the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights had conducted hearings because they wanted to know why Oakland at the time is half black, but as soon as you get to the San Leandro border at Durant and East 14th Street, they called it the Invisible Wall. There are no black people. You know, so hearings had happened. Newsweek had come and talked to some folks in town who were popping off about the blacks and the Jews and how they needed a Hitler in town to take care of the troublemaker. It was just crazy. And that's when I realized my whole project's changed. You know, it's not just my story, it's the story of the evolution of a city. So I melded those two things together, and as I said, it's a long story, but that's how I came to this show.
There's a big piece in the story about your own involvement and your mother's involvement in a lawsuit. Did that suddenly generate when you read those articles and you said, aha, now I got a hook?
I thought that just the idea itself was a hook about being the one who's different. But no, not so much. It gave me a greater sense of what my mother was up against. We moved there when I was 8 years old, and we moved into a 100-unit apartment complex, and the owner was a wealthy landowner who owned a lot of real estate and property in the East Bay. Let's just say that his views on race were well known. And once he found out we were there, apparently, he tried to do everything he could to get us out, you know, saying we had too many people with six people in a three-bedroom apartment, too many to live there, and all of this other nonsense. And they eventually served an eviction notice. And my mother, this 29-year-old single mother, took on this landowner.
How did that connection happen in your head? I mean, was there a moment when you go, aha, this is my story? And now I have the example that I can use in my play.
I felt that I knew what the story was before I realized what the historical context okay. was and what was going on. This just gave it more flavor to give the audience an idea of what it's like, what it was like for me as a young black kid to be in a city where adults are driving down the street yelling the N-word out, where I can't walk to the park with my baseball bat because I'm chased and the police pick me up and take me home because they want to know why I'm there, where I have no safe haven at home because my father was abusive and strangled me to the point where I passed out, which is why we moved in the first place from Hayward, was to get away from him. You know, so what this story does is it lets you see the world through the eyes of this little boy. And then the narrative jumps back and forth between my childhood and adulthood and the ramifications and the effects of that childhood on me as a 35-year-old man in the late 90s.
Brian Copeland, you now sat there, you've figured this out. At this point, do you know what it is yet? Have you decided it's going to be a one-man play?
I knew at the beginning. The whole idea was to write a one-man play.
Okay.
That was the whole idea. The idea was, what do I write the one-man play about?
Well, when you were doing stand-up, how close was, say, day one and day two and day three scripts for you when you're telling that stuff? I mean, what I'm asking is the difference between stand-up and doing a play.
Oh, here's the difference. It was real simple. My stand-up was always political, topical, social, and still is. I'll go out and do stand-up. I opened for Rick Springfield a couple of weeks ago. I'll still go out and do a gig here and there. But the thing with stand-up is it's all about laughs, LPMs, laughs per minute. And, you know, it's joke, 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 joke. If you're not getting a certain number of laughs per minute, you're bombing. The difference between that and a solo play is, and especially for me, is that I do characters in this play. I do 30-something. Some odd characters in Genuine. And if you asked me before, and people did say, you should put some characters in your act. And I said, I can't do characters. I can't do voices. And I never knew until I pushed myself. But there are long periods in Genuine where there aren't any laughs, where it's very serious and very heavy. What I did is I was a big fan of the Norman Lear sitcoms of the 70s. All, right. You know, my mother sat us down as kids. We watched All in the Family and Maude and Good Times. And I loved how it was really, really funny, and then you get kicked in the gut with something like Edith, you know, a rape attempt for, on Edith Bunker. Remember that episode?
Right.
And then it's really funny again, and then, you know, really funny, and Maude has an abortion. And really, you know, and so that's the rhythm. It's a roller coaster rhythm, and that was deliberately by design, where you're laughing really hard, then something comes out of left field that just is gut-wrenching, and then there's something funny to pull you out of that hole that I just dug.
But another difference is that when you're working on a play, I mean, you're staying within the parameters of the script. When you're doing stand-up,
right.
I assume you have a chart of sorts, but within that chart you can do what you want, and you also don't have a director and you don't have a writer.
Right, and you can, you know, you can deviate, you know, certainly, but most guys, most comics, when they get their act, you know, that's your act. You know, you'll change it and you'll break new pieces in and adjust things, especially doing topical humor. It changes so
right.
fast. The shelf life is so short. Whereas with a play, you know, once the play was set in opening night, the play was locked, as we call it, then that's it. That's the play. Now, over the years, you know, the play was supposed to run for 6 weeks and I'd be done and that was it. You know, and, you know, who knew? It ended up running 2.5 years in the city, became the longest running one-man show in the history of Bay Area theater, and I ran it for 7 years. And over the years, there have been nips and tucks and, you know, some references that don't necessarily fit that I pulled out, but it's the same play.
I keep thinking, you know, here I am doing a program, and of course it changes all the time. I get on the air, I do, mm-hmm. you know, plugs, it changes all the time. You do a show, changes every day, you don't repeat yourself. Obviously, a stand-up comic goes through the same routines, but again, there's changes. You get bored with something, you drop it.
Right.
You know, people stop laughing, obviously you drop it. Something
right.
new comes in, you change your timing. But when you're doing a play 700 times over a 10-year period, Brian Copeland, how do you stay fresh?
Well, actually, over a 7-year period, I stopped it a couple
okay.
of years ago, which is why the Berkeley Rep run is so special. It's a remounting after
okay.
a 10-year celebration. But here's what keeps it fresh. Out of those 700-plus performances, I think we're close to 750 or something now, out of those 750 or so performances, no two audiences have been the same. And that's what keeps it fresh. That's what keeps it fresh. Some laugh at every single joke. Some don't laugh at the jokes at all because they're so deeply into the story. And everybody takes something different from the show. As I mentioned to you off the air, there are a lot of folks in fair housing who are attracted to the show because of the fair housing aspect of it. We talk about the things, I talk about the things that were done to us, which are common landlord tricks, you know, to discriminate against folks. There is the depression aspect because I went through a very deep bout of depression in 1999. That was the result of this and some other things. And so folks who deal with depression, they take that. Then there, again, there's the racial identity issue. You know, as I have been called an Oreo, I found out that's in every culture. You know, Asians who are too Eurocentric for their Asian peers, they call them bananas and Twinkies, yellow on the outside, white on the inside. Latinos, they'll call coconuts. And it's the same nonsense. So those folks take that away from it. Then there's the general idea of and concept of racism in America and what it really means. And I go, you know, into some pretty deep discussions about it, the subtleties of it. And I revisit some of those themes in The Scion, things such as white privilege and the benefit of the doubt, whereas black people have to earn the respect of white people, whereas white people automatically, you have the respect until you lose it. See,
right.
it's the opposite, it's the reverse. So there are folks who are fascinated by that. There are a lot of college classes across the country require the book, which is fascinating to me. My life is on a test. Sociology and African-American studies classes. So, well, drama classes, of course, and psych classes, and yeah.
So how did you come to the book?
After reviews came out the first week, you couldn't get into the place for the next 2.5 years, as I said. And I got a call from a lit agent by the name of Amy Rennert. And Amy had been a producer on my very first talk show on KQED back in 1992. I hosted a late night show called Q, and she became a lit agent. She said, I've read the review and I think this might make a good book. And I really, because coincidentally on my someday list, write a book was number two. That was the second thing on my someday list. So we put together this proposal. I wrote an outline, a couple of chapters, and it sold in 3 days. There was a bidding war. for it. It sold in 3 days.
What's the difference between the book and the play?
Book, I go into a lot more detail. I'm able to go into a lot more detail than I can go into in a two-hour stage presentation. There are a lot of things that I allude to in the play, and you get what it is that I'm talking about, that I can really, you know, dive into in 60, 70,000. I think it's about 65,000 words, I think, that book is. So there's a lot more depth.
Let's move on a little bit to how you got involved with the Bucket List movie.
Just a coincidence. I like to say my whole career has been a fluke, a series of happy coincidences. So after the reviews came out for Genuine, about 2 weeks or so into the run, I had Carl Reiner on my program again. And I said, hey, you know, I took your advice. I found my piece of ground. And here's what I did. I've written this play. People seem to like it. It's going very well. And he said, well, do you have a recording of it? And coincidentally, we had done a recording like a week before because my idea was, you know, again, this was supposed to be a six-week run, and then I'd be done and on to something else. I had club dates booked, stand-up club dates booked. The idea was I'll tape this so that way someday when I have grandkids, I can go, here's something I did when I was younger. And he said, well, send it to me. So I sent it to him, and like 3 days later, I get a call from him. He goes, I saw this. This is wonderful. This is great. You know who needs to see this? Robbie should see this. And I'm like, Robbie who? And, oh, my God, Rob Reiner. Oh, that's who he's talking about. So, you know, he apparently sent it to Rob, and I get a call a couple of days later that he wants he and his producing partner, Alan Greisman, want to meet me at Castle Rock Entertainment in Beverly Hills to talk about this thing. So what I wanted to do, and this is also on my list, was to do a television series. And I wanted to do a series based on the book, and they loved the idea, and we got a deal set up with HBO. Our pilot script didn't sell, and so I'm still trying to develop it, but that happened. And during the time that we were meeting, I'd always go to Castle Rock to meet with them about script things and script changes. They were working on a film, and they had me meet them on the Warner's lot. So I come in, we have our meeting. I ask what's the movie you're doing? He says, film called The Bucket List. He tells me what it's about. And then I'm getting up from my chair. My butt is just off the chair. And I go, well, if Morgan Freeman needs a son or something, call me. And Rob looks at Alan and goes, well, he's the right age. I was kidding. I was just kidding. And I go, really? He goes, yeah, I guess you want to do it? And I go, well, do you want me to read? He goes, nah, it's a couple lines. And he threw me the script. And that's how I got into Bucket List. Now, most, you know, I had lines and everything, and all these family scenes that we did, you know, I played Morgan's younger son, his real son, Alfonso Freeman, played the older son. We did all these family scenes and things on this. We actually went to the set of Jeopardy. That's the original part where Morgan, I don't know if you've seen the movie, but the original part where Morgan's character gets sick and collapses is different on the screen than what it was originally. It was originally going to happen on Jeopardy with Alex Trebek and the whole thing. All that stuff got cut. So you see me, I'm like in three or four shots, and I have billing, and I get residuals, which is wonderful. Fine, a couple times a year, I go, oh, okay, Bucket List, the gift that keeps on giving.
So at this point, you're working on the play, you're doing it in various places, and at that point, are you starting to think, well, you know, I got other things to do, and that's how the waiting period came up, or is that when Jewelry Box came up?
No, waiting period I didn't start until I stopped Genuine. I started Genuine in 04, and I stopped performing it in 2011 is when I stopped performing it. And, you know, for ages, people were asking me what my follow-up play was going to be. And, you know, the sophomore, anything when you've had a big hit with your first one is difficult because they got their knives out. You know, the second movie you do, if the first one's a hit, the second book, if the first one's a hit, and so on. So one of the things that some of the critics had written about the play was that they had wished that I had gone into more detail about, the depression aspect of it. So I decided I was going to write this. Well, I shouldn't say I decided. I thought about writing a play about depression. I have really, you know, I suffer from bad bouts, sometimes suicidal bouts. And I had this horrible suicidal bout back in 2008 after a series of calamities. My wife had taken off, you know, and left, you know, I'd remarried, and she decided she wouldn't be married anymore and took off. My grandmother, who's one of the main characters in Genuine, and the woman who raised me after my mother passed, suddenly died, had a stroke and suddenly died. I get into a car accident, and I total my car, and I end up with the spinal cord situation, where I had a disc in my neck pressed against the spinal cord, and emergency surgery, and I was almost quadriplegic. And I'm laid up for 3 months and just depressed, laid up and depressed. And I decided I was going to check out. So I went to a gun store, and I bought a .32 caliber Beretta Tomcat, with the plan being I was going to check out. And in California, there is a 10-day waiting period in order to get a firearm. So during that 10 days, I came to my senses. But I thought about turning that into a play. And then the nephew of some dear friends of mine, 15 years old, laid down on the railroad tracks up in Oakley. This is back in 2011, January 2011. He laid down on the railroad tracks and committed suicide. And that's what made me think, okay, time to stop thinking about this and actually write it. And maybe I can give people some insight into what depression really is. And that depression is not something you can just shake off or you can, you know, people don't get it. The people around people who are depressed just don't get it. Hey, it's sun shining outside. You know, you could be in Darfur right now. You could be in Afghanistan with your legs blown off. Look at everything you got going. And it has nothing to do with it. It's an illness, and people need to be able to understand, you know, that and treat it as such. And the other part of it that I wanted to really convey was that people who are sufferers need to realize that it's nothing to be embarrassed or ashamed of any more than you'd be embarrassed or ashamed for having cancer or Lou Gehrig's disease, leukemia, or anything else. It's a disease. And when you are feeling suicidal or feeling like doing harm, to tell someone. So it was very risky, and I you know, wrote it, and David Ford, who is my director and collaborator, and I worked on this for quite a while, and we wanted to write a show about depression that wasn't a depressing show. It's very, very funny in a lot of places, just like Genuine Roller Coaster Ride. And fortunately, the critics were very, very kind. But the most gratifying part of it is that I get so many. I haven't done that show in about a year, and I get emails from people telling me how that show changed their lives. One gentleman who was an Iraq war vet said he was suicidal, you know, and he had been PTSD and suicidal ever since he got back. And he had refused the overtures of his wife to help or to seek any kind of professional help. And he walked out of the waiting period and decided, okay, that was the nudge. And he went and got help. And now he's, you know, he's okay. You know, he's not in that place anymore. Another wonderful letter I got from a woman who said that she'd been married for 15 years, and her husband didn't want to hear about her depression, never wanted to hear about it. And she dragged him to the show, kicking and screaming. And then on the drive home from that play, he says to her, "Is that what you go through? Tell me about it." And for the first time in their marriage, they were able to have a conversation about, you know, what she deals with and how it affects her. It affects her behavior and her moods and what he can do to be supportive. And that's just great. And that's the show that is probably the most requested show I have. A couple times a week, somebody asks me, when am I bringing it back? Will I bring it back?
Have you thought about turning that into a book as well?
In fact, I did. I wrote I have a novella that I wrote based on that show, and I've not been able to sell it because the publishers are afraid of that topic, and especially the way that I deal with it, that there is humor as well as pathos in telling that story. So I may just publish it myself because there is definitely a demand for it. But a lot of folks from suicide prevention groups and mental health organizations came and see that show. Now, I had to stop doing that show. I did that show for a year and a half. I had to stop because in the parts of that play where I'm depressed, same as with Genuine, I go there. I have to go there in order to make it real for my audience. And that started to eat at me, and I found myself going down the rabbit hole.
Brian Copeland, that brings up an interesting question about working on all of these plays. What do you do? You know, you got a gig. I mean, I'm sure it's the same when you were stand-up, too. How do you deal with incredible depression when you have to go on that night and be funny, or go on that night and do a play about depression, or go on that night and do Genuine Black Man?
Well, I'll tell you, the hardest performance I ever had to do was when Grandma died. I had a run that was beginning the day after she passed away at the San Jose Stage Company. First time I'd been there, first time I'd performed the play in the South Bay, and I wanted to cancel, and my sister said, "No, Grandma would kill you if you canceled that show." And it's so difficult because I have to channel her. I do her. She's a character in the play. And I didn't think I could get through it, and I did, and then I went back to the dressing room and broke down. Like Woody Allen, and not that I am anywhere nearly as talented as Woody Allen is, but what they say about Woody Allen is that he has a great ability to compartmentalize. Everybody around him says that. He can compartmentalize. Right. And I think I have, to a certain degree, that same gift. There's something horrible going on in my life. I can take my mind off of it long enough to take care of business and leave it over there. So that's how I do it. But I've gone on stage when there have been some just horrific things, awful things that happened. And during that, genuine, it's 2 hours. During that 2 hours, all that's there is the play in the audience. And then when it's over, then I deal with the junk.
I guess sort of the same, you know, just getting on KGO or KPFA. I
mean, sure.
We all have up and down days. The difference is you're doing it in front of an audience.
Yeah.
As you know, doing radio is so different than being live in front of people.
It's instant gratification is what it is when you're in front of an audience that's there with you, even though the audience of radio obviously is larger. But that helped, too. When Grandma passed away, I was doing San Jose Stage Company, and KGO just gave me a bunch of fill-in work for, like, I worked every day for, like, 60 or 70 days, and that's how I dealt with it, because as long as I was focused on something else, I compartmentalized, I wasn't sad.
And then Jewelry Box, and then Cyan.
Jewelry Box is another story that I thought about, had it in my head for a long time, and the Marsh needed a Christmas show. And so I said to David Ford, here's my idea, you know, what do you think? And he said, yeah, let's do it. And that show came out fully formed. That's the, you know, every other play took a lot of time in terms of you know, figuring out how to present certain scenes, and whether it's a narration scene or it's a scene that's fully embodied. Whereas Jewelry Box came out as a full-term baby, is how that play came out. And what that play is about is it's Christmas of 1970. I'm 6 years old, and we've just moved from Akron, Ohio to East Oakland, to near 98th and Eads, a rough neighborhood back then and even rougher today. What it's about is it's the first week of December, and I'm with my family at the old White Front store. I don't know if you remember White Front stores or not. They were kind of the precursor to the big box stores. They were all throughout the Southwest. You know, think of like a Walmart. That's what White Front was like. And I wanted to buy my mother a jewelry box. I decided to buy her a jewelry box for Christmas because we moved around a lot in the previous 6-8 months, and she left hers behind in one of the moves. And it cost $11.97. So what the play's about is all of the things, all the trials and tribulations I go through in 1970 Oakland to try to earn $11.97 by myself. And it's cute, and it's funny, and it's charming, and at the end of the show, people just cry at the end of that show. And I was just so thrilled with the reception and the reviews, and I'm going to bring that back this year.
And Cyan is non-autobiography. It's about murders at a sausage factory, and it's also about racism.
Well, here's the deal. It's another San Leandro story. Stuart Alexander was the third generation owner of the Santos Linguisa factory. He was royalty in the town of San Leandro for, you know, that family was royalty. Three generations of San Leandrans were weaned on Santos Linguisa, large Portuguese population and you know, folks who were descended from Portuguese folks that settled there. So the problem was that this man was a sociopath who did a lot of awful and horrible things, you know, violent and just terrible things that you or I would have gone to jail for earlier. And because of who he was and his sense of entitlement, people just let him get away with it, up to the point where he felt that he did not have to listen to the USDA, and he didn't have to listen to, you know, the state meat inspectors or follow regulations, and he could do whatever he wanted.
Sounds sort of Donald Sterling-ish.
Yeah, I guess to a certain extent. And so what happened is he murdered these three people, videotaped himself.
That's a little bit beyond
murdering.
Donald Sterling, yeah.
Yeah, they came down to issue a notice of violation to him and his factory, and he murdered them. Again, affluenza, thinking that he was going to get away with it because he'd never been held accountable for anything else, beating people up, hitting people in the head with baseball bats, any of the other horrible things he'd done throughout his life. So he had a friend who I don't call by his real name in the play, who was somebody who worked in city government for a long time, who for ages was after me, after Genuine, saying, you have to tell this story. Nobody else but you can tell the story. And finally I came around to, okay, what is it about the story that bothers him? And I did some research, and I was just appalled to find out this history. I mean, anybody who knew this guy should have seen this coming. They should have seen this coming. And what I am in this play, in that I contrast some of my experiences having to deal with police and things with his experiences of never being held accountable. You know, I'm 19 years old, and I'm helping a white girl I have a crush on move from one apartment to another. She's driving the U-Haul. Police pull us over, and they want to check my ID. They want to know why they want to make sure that she's okay. I'm not kidding. The cop wants to know if she's all right and she's okay, and checks and runs my ID. So whereas, you know, the first time you see Stuart Alexander in Scion, he's writing, he's about my age, and he's riding down that same street where I was stopped, very busy street in San Leandro, full throttle on a kid's motor scooter against traffic, the wrong way. And he does eventually get pulled over, but nothing becomes of it, nothing because of who he is. So I wanted to talk about that and about privilege in that play, and especially about white privilege that, you know, so many people are just oblivious to the fact that they have white privilege and they just don't get it, that they're automatically getting the benefit of the doubt that African Americans especially do not get. You know, Barack Obama, some people will not even give him the benefit of the doubt when he says that he was born here. You know, so those are the themes that I touch on in that show. And that was a real balancing act in a number of ways. You know, how much of myself do I insert into this story in terms of comparing and contrasting? You know, there is a lot of humor in this story, but obviously none of it deals with the actual murders. There's a lot of humor around other aspects of the theme of affluenza and privilege and so on and so forth. But again, I'm very fortunate that show was well received, and it will be back.
What is the Carolina Foundation, Brian Copeland?
My mother, Carolyn, and my grandmother, Lena, and what the idea behind the Carolina Foundation, we're just starting, we haven't done very much at all, is I want to provide scholarships to young women who have come through extraordinary circumstances, have overcome extraordinary circumstances, and provide scholarships in education and scholarships to help them in the arts. We're just getting started. That means we have no money. That's what I'm saying. We've started it, but we've got no money.
You were on something called, Seven Live?
Oh, yeah, I hosted. It was an afternoon show that I hosted on ABC7 from 2010 to 2012 when Katie Couric took our time slot. It was a lot of fun, most fun I ever had in television.
Well, when you're doing mainstream media as you do, I mean, obviously, you know, being who you are, you pretty much can say what you want, do what you want, I would guess. What kind of limitations do you get? I mean, here we are on non-commercial Pacifica Radio. What kind of limitations do you have in mainstream AM radio as a talk show host?
Well, you know, the limitations and restrictions are because of the fact that it is a commercial, there are an awful lot of commercials. As well as the fact that, you know, the rating system has changed in the last couple of years, whereas for decades it was diaries that certain people were assigned based upon their particular demographic to fill out what it is that they listen to. And now it's people meters, where it's like a pager that those same folks carry around that pick up what it is that they're listening to. You know, a lot of us in broadcasting think that that's really unfair, because, you know, what that means is that easy listening stations are always going to win. Because if you don't choose to turn that on and you're in the office, well, that's what they're playing in the office, because it's not offensive. You know, those kinds of things. So we have to be very aware of timing and how audience is measured ratings-wise in terms of when we take breaks and all these other things. So that can be somewhat confining.
What about fear of people just, like, calling you up and saying, you dirty so-and-so? I mean, I'm sure you get a lot of those.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. You know, no matter what, if you take a definitive stance on anything, you're going to have people who are going to argue with you. If I say, I think that Friday's the best day of the week, there are going to be people who call and say, are you crazy? It's Saturday's the best day of the week. No, Sunday is, because Sunday you don't have to work. And, you know, so there's always going to be controversy whenever you take a definitive stand.
Well, what about on any given stand? Like, for instance, your view toward race is certainly, you know, say to the left of the mainstream.
I wouldn't say that to the left.
So?
I wouldn't say to the left of the mainstream. You mentioned Donald Sterling. Look at what happened to Donald Sterling. You think to the people who were upset and appalled and demanding that he be banned from the NBA, or people who were the left of the mainstream? I think that is the mainstream now. That these things won't be tolerated. See what I mean about, this is talk radio, you see? But see, you asked me a question, you challenged me, and I came back. That answers your question. That's how it works.
Well,
thank you very much for your call. It's 11:52 here now on KPFA.
Here's the thing. Look, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into it because this is a tape show, but Sterling did nothing more or less than what Marchant did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And he got away with doing it more surreptitiously for 20 years
yep.
in between. And, yes, if you go over the top publicly, you're going to be shot down. But if you keep it a little bit under the surface, like your man did at the Sausage Factory, like Donald Sterling
did.
He
wasn't under the surface.
But he got away with it until he murdered people.
Well, he got away with it. It wasn't under the surface. He got away with it. People knew who he was, knew what he was about.
Well, they knew
who
Sterling was.
They just didn't call him to account for it. Well, not everybody. People in the NBA knew. The general public didn't know.
Well,
Clippers fans didn't know what Sterling was like.
I'm not sure about that. Look at the Elgin Baylor lawsuit. I mean, it was out there. It was out there. It was out there. It was out there.
Good point.
You know, and nobody bothered. Nobody bothered. They said, yeah, we can't do anything. He's an owner. He's an owner. He's got that privilege.
Yeah.
He's got that privilege, right?
Yeah, good. You make a good point. You do make a good point.
Yeah. Brian Copeland, what else do you have on tap? In terms of work, you're going to be writing another book, or you're doing another play?
Well, we're still trying to get Genuine developed, and we're going to be shooting developed for television, and we're going to be shooting some scenes. It's a presentation reel coming up in the next couple of weeks, and then I go to L.A., and I'm performing all four of my plays in Los Angeles, all four of them over a three-day period.
When is that going
to
be?
That is going to be the weekend after the 4th of July. I've written a book, a novella based on Jewelry Box that will be out in the fall. And I've got another play that I'll be starting soon for next year for the Marsh's 25th anniversary. So I've got another play that I'll probably sit down and start writing in the next couple of weeks. Actually, I'll probably begin the process.
You've been listening to an interview with Brian Copeland, author of Not a Genuine Black Man, which is a book and also a play, and the playwright of other plays, which are going to be seen here and there over the years. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.